This is the Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. 40 years ago, one of the most momentous events in the history of politics and television took place. C-SPAN started broadcasting live gavel-gavel coverage of the United States House of Representatives. Long before reality TV shows like The Real World, Survivor, The Real Housewives, or whatever, Big Brother, or Sober House, C-SPAN gave Americans direct access to one of the most powerful groups of people on the planet. They were powerful, but they were also kind of sequestered from public view. For the first time in history, we could see our elected officials debating, wheeling and dealing, freaking out, and more than on a few occasions, falling asleep while debating government spending, foreign policy, and more. Since its start, C-SPAN has expanded its coverage to include coverage of the Senate, daily public affairs shows featuring policy experts, activists, journalists, and lawmakers, long-form interviews with authors and other influentials, coverage of events all around the country, and much more. In a world in which elite decision-makers want to shield themselves from all forms of scrutiny and observation, even as they get more powerful, C-SPAN performs the radical intervention of putting a camera on them while also engaging them and others in thoughtful, frank, and fair conversation. Today on The Reason Podcast, I'm extremely happy to talk with one of my media heroes, the creator of C-SPAN, Brian Lamb, who's managed to shine a light on the political process while simultaneously creating a model of civil discourse that's simply unmatched in cable news, print news, and whatever other kind of news there is out there. So, Brian Lamb, thank you for talking to Reason.
Nick Gillespie, thank you for caring about our 40th anniversary.
Set the scene for me. Why did you want to create C-SPAN when you did? You first started, in the very late 70s, and then it comes on air in 1979. But what was driving you to say, you know, we need C-SPAN?
I am not absolutely sure when this happened, but I grew up in a very nice little town of Lafayette, Indiana, and I joined the Navy and went off to see the world. It's that simple. And as I started to see the world, I realized how much was available in certain parts of the country that wasn't available to me in Lafayette. I grew up watching the three big networks that were located in New York City. I was interested. I started doing radio and television when I was in high school and college. I went to Purdue. And It just seemed to me that we were getting the same message from everybody, and that the three networks had an enormous amount of power. I didn't find anything, there weren't anything bad about them. It's just they had so much power, and there was so much more going on in the world than they were telling us about. And I started to look at it closely and study it, and eventually, in 1977, once the satellite had been launched, we were able to start dreaming about doing things on television that weren't mass audience oriented. And that's what it came out of, just talking to people in the cable television industry that nobody was paying attention to and suggesting that maybe we could do something other than just entertainment television and sports. And that's how it started.
How did your experience when you were in the Navy or right after it, you worked for Robert McNamara for a while, the defense secretary during the Vietnam War, who, you know, is a shorthand cliche for, you know, just a really smart man who ultimately had a kind of monstrous effect on, you know, on history and on government policy. And you also worked in Richard Nixon's White House. How did this affect your belief or your desire for government transparency?
Well, it's a stretch to say that I worked for Robert McNamara. I was in his Pentagon when he was the Secretary of Defense, working in the Defense Office of Public Affairs. And my immediate boss was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force. I mean, I didn't get close to Robert McNamara. Actually, I never met him until after.
But now you're just trying to distance yourself. You were a cog in the war machine, weren't you, Brian? I mean, isn't the grunt on the front line just as guilty as the general?
Oh, I'm sure they are. The point is that I was
I
was
understand.
An observer. I was in the military. Mm-hmm. I was an observer. It was in the middle of the Vietnam War. At the same time, I worked in the Pentagon. I was also a social aide to Lyndon Johnson, and I was observing there. It was very interesting to be that close to people in power. And then I...
What do you mean by a... I'm sorry, what is a social aide? Were you like filling his glass with bourbon?
No.
Or what does that mean?
No. You would be invited to come to the White House and work their social occasions, and you were an extension, and this sounds a little bit too close for comfort, an extension of the first family, but in effect, you really just did what the social secretary told you to do, and it was a collateral duty, and I spent 2 years doing that in the Johnson White House in the middle of the Vietnam War. Again, close enough, but certainly not important to anybody.
But you got to be an observer of how all of this functioned. And then what about the Nixon stuff? What were you doing in the Nixon White House?
Well, I had worked in the 1968 Nixon campaign, and I hate to keep saying this, but it's important just to understand how close I wasn't. I worked in an outfit called Speak to Nixon Agnew, and I was only there for 2.5 months. And it was Citizens for Nixon Agnew. And it was an organization that was set up so that people that wanted to play politics could get in it, but it had nothing to do with the campaign. We were sent out to the country to do different things just to I actually always thought they put the headquarters at the Willard Hotel there in Washington, and often and the Willard had been shut down, and so it was empty, and they were going to redo it. And I always thought that when I started to look back on it, that anybody that wanted to get into politics and get into work in the Nixon group that they didn't really want close to the campaign, they would send to the Willard. And so I got a job that sent me out to Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, again, involved but not close. And after that, I wanted to go to work in the Nixon White House communications office, and I didn't get the job. And eventually, I went up to Capitol Hill, worked for a senator from a state that I wasn't from, excuse me, and learned about a job open with somebody named Tom Whitehead. His full name was Clay Whitehead, and he started a little office called the Office of Telecommunications Policy. It's important to the story because when I went there, again, I was a generalist, and I did the media and congressional relations, and he was only 32 years old when I went there, and I was 29. And our general counsel at the time was somebody named Antonin Scalia.
Holy cow. I have in my apartment right now where I'm broadcasting, I have a bunch of pictures with red threads tied between the different pictures, and you're giving me a whole new set of threads that I'm going to have to. So it's Brian Lamb, Antonin Scalia, Richard Nixon, LBJ. You were obviously part of the JFK assassination, weren't you?
Absolutely not. But, you know, all this, as I've always said, is to young people, now that I'm an old man, I've always said to young people, just get involved. And don't worry about what the title is, and that's what I was doing in those
days.
This
is what you told a young Roger Stone on the Nixon campaign. So just get involved. Just get involved.
Never met Roger Stone, but have observed him for years. Loved the tattoo on his back. Always thought it said a lot. But anyway, that's, you know, step by step, and you're learning, you're observing, and frankly, and I had tried to go to work for ABC, NBC, and CBS, and they all said no. You know, it's a lot of turndowns in those early years. And so eventually, the good news was the power was taken away from only NBC, ABC, and CBS by the launching of the satellite and the creation of the satellite connection to cable. That's how I got involved and had no idea what I was doing, was just kept moving. That's how it started.
But I'm assuming, and I might be wrong here, but that when you are, you know, you're on the periphery of power, but you're in a position where you can observe it and you can see the disconnect between what's going on within, say, Washington, D.C., and you were saying, you know, places like New York and L.A., maybe Chicago, and the rest of the country. I mean, so were those experiences on the periphery of power important to your developing an ethic of, you know, we should be seeing how government works?
extremely important, although seeing how government works was important, but the most important thing to me was reducing the power of the three networks so that we had more opportunities to see more sides of more issues. And it kind of evolved into the eventual reason that people in the cable industry were willing to take a chance with this place was because they knew that we were going to be televising the House of Representatives. They understood what that meant. There was no question of what that meant. And also, it was going to be done in a very inexpensive way.
Before we, I want you to explain how C-SPAN is funded, because it's fascinating. And nowadays, the cable industry is not held in the same kind of ill repute that it was even 20 or 30 years ago. A vast majority of people, so, you know, in the 90% range, or, you know, in the high 90s, now get television delivered, television and other things delivered via cable. But in the late 70s, cable was not a thing yet, right? And why wasn't it bigger? And then was C-SPAN just kind of a way of them saying to people, look, we're going to do public interest broadcasting just like the networks do, so give us a break?
It wasn't that neat a package when it all started. Mm-hmm. You had a bunch of mostly men, almost all men, who got into the business of cable television to serve communities that didn't have clear pictures. They were in mountainous regions, they were in small towns, and they would deliver the channels from the big cities in there so that they'd have some choice. Mm-hmm. It started out just that basic because it was too expensive to be able to transmit programs all over the United States. That's where the satellite comes in 1974-75. Mm-hmm. Once that happened, HBO was the leader. HBO went up on the satellite and put movies without ads all over the United States into these cable systems. Everybody started seeing the opportunity to build cable in all the big markets because mm-hmm. you could bring something in unique. It didn't have to be just another over-the-air television station. And so all these guys that were in the business were looking for new ideas. And I just came into the middle of that and mm-hmm. said, I have an idea, and wasn't sophisticated. And there was one guy in the room that said, I like that idea, and said, I'm going to do what I can to help you. And that's how it started. And he was a business guy. I wasn't. He liked the idea because he was civic-minded. It had nothing to do with some people thought it was a lobbying tool. He didn't mm-hmm. give a hoot about a lobbying tool. And that's really where it started. The guy's name was Bob Rosencrantz. He's unfortunately not with us any longer, but he was a terrific human being.
When you say in the room, what was the room?
The room was at the Mayflower Hotel.
It was like the Cable Association or like the professional trade group?
I love these terms. It was an ad hoc group of cable television system owners looking for ideas. And this sounds so government, they formed something called the Cable Satellite Access Entity, CSAE, and they had these meetings, and they would invite people to come in and pitch them. And I was just one of those guys that got 30 minutes one day out of the goodness of the fellow's heart that ran the thing. And that's how, that was when it started, right there in the Mayflower Hotel.
And your pitch was basically, I want to do live coverage of the House of Representatives.
No. My pitch was, let's do something other than movies and sports, and let's do, public affairs television, and mm-hmm. let's start an unlimited way to see how much we can do. And actually, the fellow that said, I like the idea, went back to the industry one-on-one. He knew them all very well, and they said, no, we don't want to do that. We don't want to pay for that. And then it was a month or two later, the idea popped in to do the House of Representatives, and that's when they said, yeah, we like that one. We'll pay for that one.
And what is the phrase of art that C-SPAN, in all of its kind of promotional moments, it says C-SPAN is funded by the Cable
Association? Television Ministry.
Okay, yeah. And so this is a thing, it's an instance where a bunch of profit-seeking businessmen and women have decided to fund something that they think is a good add-on to their project.
Yes, and I made it really clear to them that I had absolutely no interest in putting anything together that would require government taxpayer money from the government fund, that this should be independent of you know, all government connection, and it would be a journalistic institution, and that we wouldn't be regulated, and we could make up our own minds and all that kind of stuff. Those are all very important, because at that time the television industry was heavily regulated.
You famously don't do ratings. Why not?
Well, I took a couple of reasons. I'm not sure I would ever want to see on an hour-to-hour basis what the ratings were, because in some cases when you have a quorum call on the floor of the United States Senate for 3 hours, you know nobody's watching, and mm-hmm. if everybody hangs on the ratings, they're going to say, "What? That's worthless." They may say it's worthless anyway, but the other thing is that if you make decisions based on ratings, you're not going to give balance necessarily. You can, but you don't often. You're not going to cover events that happen in the government process that don't sound exciting and may not be exciting, but spend a lot of your money.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were fortunate that these people in the cable business, and have to, you know, give them 150% credit, never cared about ratings. They said, "We're going to do this. This is a civic kind of thing." And we were able to be a part of this tremendous and, frankly, very significant money-making venture that they had, and we were just kind of the tail on the dog.
What are some of, you know, when I think about C-SPAN, and I've been watching it for as long as I think I've had access to cable, which would have kicked in somewhere in the 80s, probably. I grew up in the New York media market in New Jersey, but, you know, I think of watching the House vote on TARP back in 2008, which I was in the Reason office in D.C., and we were watching that like, you know, it was a football game in triple overtime, sudden death, the vote tally shifting, whatnot. I love watching, images or clip reels of Robert Byrd and other politicians falling asleep while people are talking. Rand Paul's 2013 filibuster against drones during the Brennan CIA nomination, et cetera. You know, I mean, I can think of some favorite of moments of mine from C-SPAN's live coverage of the House of Representatives and the Senate. What are some of your favorite moments over the past 40 years?
I think the most significant thing over the past 40 years that ever went on here was the change of leadership in the parties back in the 80s. And the reason I mention this is because we actually could watch the change. And you can pick your flavor, but mm-hmm. When Tip O'Neill was there and Newt Gingrich challenged him and was successful in 1995 of becoming Speaker of the House, and watching that process from 79 to 95 mm-hmm. was the most important thing that we've been able to see. I mean, there are all kinds of individual things and different speeches and hearings and all that stuff, but we watched it happen. And after the Republican Party had been out of power for 40 years and watching that change, that's overall the most important thing that we were able to show. You can pick out anything you want to from the budget debates, and now we're sitting here with $22 trillion in debt. Clearly the budget debates have had little or no significance. But I must say, I thought that when the American people could see how the money was spent, that they would be more responsible, and it's just been the opposite. And I don't understand that part of it. But,
well, I was going to ask, have there been any unintended consequences to filming Congress? Because I agree with you. You know, this was, you know, one of the dreams of transparency is that when people see, you know, start to see the sausage being made, they're going to be like, you know, hey, clean up the kitchen back there. And instead, it seems it's more like, well, now that I see everybody else is getting money, I want mine too. And, you know, let the bill be damned. Just put it on the credit card.
Very interesting way you put that. I don't know what – I've never thought about the unintended consequences. We used to get a lot of criticism because they – people would write and people would say, because cameras are there, it's changed them. The number of hours that they're in session has not changed. The I guess this was neither an intended or unintended consequence. I think you do see more people show up at some of these hearings than members of Congress, instead of having just their staff sit there and tell them what happened. But on occasion, you see the chairs are empty because they've got so many. They're on so many committees, and they don't have any time, and they spend a lot of their time raising money. I think one thing that I always thought would happen is that now a lot of people around the country know what their Congress looks like, and they've been able to watch. And I think this is really significant, and it had nothing to do with us, but they've been able to watch the change in membership of the House and Senate. When I first came to town, Margaret Chase Smith was the only woman in the Senate. There are now 23 women. They're in the House of Representatives. If we just watched 100 new people walk into town, and right away you see these new faces. And there are a lot of people besides Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. The media's overwhelmed by her, and she's their favorite thing to go to right now. I shouldn't say thing, I mean person. And she's important, but there are all these other new members of Congress who are attractive and well-spoken and interesting and have good interesting backgrounds, and we've covered them all. And otherwise, you would only think there was one new member of Congress or two or three, and that's one of the advantages if you're interested.
C-SPAN has always been an early adopter in new technology. I mean, itself is an instance of that. One of the things that is amazing, and this, and I say this as a journalist who's been with a magazine that's been around for 50 years. I started there 25 years ago. We struggled to kind of get online and make sense of it, and to, and then to move into video or podcasting or whatever. But you guys, you're on cable, you're on radio, the internet, you supply transcripts, you allow people to make clips out of anything that you air and post them wherever they want. What is the thinking behind that? Where did that energy and that vision come from?
Oh, I think it's all part of a group of people here who came when they were 22 and now they're 55, and they were able to build this place. There are 270 colleagues here. They were able to build this place out of whole cloth. And then every time you see things change, you say, we ought to be a part of it. We were the first ones to stream nationally in 1995 and on the internet. And we streamed everything we have free of charge to everybody. And nobody paid a whole lot of attention to it at that time. Now it's the flavor of the day.
Oh, God. No. Well, and it's amazing. I mean, what do you have? Something you have, like, I don't know how many millions of hours you must have online where, it's just this incredible repository of meaningful conversations that are waiting to be discovered, kind of. So
you're very kind to mention. I mean, the fact is that Robert Browning, a professor at Purdue University, working with us, created the archive that we have that has 200, I don't know, I haven't seen the latest number, 240,000 hours of discussion on it from the early days of C-SPAN that is wide open to anybody to see and use worldwide. Free of charge, you don't have to pay a dime to anybody. This is all a product of what cable television executives decided to do back in the late 70s.
How do you decide or develop programming that is not simply about kind of political procedure in the House or the Senate? Because there's also, you have Washington Journal and a host of other kind of public affairs shows. You take a bus around the country and you do things like going to different presidential libraries. You have emerged over the past 40 years, or certainly over the past 30 years, as a as one of the great interviewers, particularly of book authors and whatnot. How do you come up with those types of programs?
Well, most of it, everything we've done here, in my case, I've learned from others. In the very early days when we started our call-in show on October the 7th, 1980, I had been a 2-year listener to the Larry King show at night. I loved what Larry King did on the radio. I wasn't as interested in what he did on television, but I thought on radio it was a fantastic opportunity. 5 hours a night I used to listen to him as we were putting C-SPAN together all the time. And you got to know somebody so well. And when we started, nobody ever was able to talk back to their television set. They were always, the people in Sixth Avenue in New York were saying, here's what you're going to get. This is it. And we have three channels and we're all going to do the same thing. And you can't talk back to us and you're going to have to take what we give you. And when we started, I said, this was an opportunity for the public to talk back to their television set. And that was, you know, as I said, connected to having listened to Larry King, who started the Nationwide Radio Call-In Show in 1978. No matter what we've done here, it's a play off of others. It's just been able to expand it. And, you know, if you go back in the history, the television networks periodically, if they were interested, would televise hearings. Mm-hmm. If they were controversial enough, if they thought they could keep an audience and still keep their advertisers. And when we came along, it says, let's do it all the time. Let's do it every day. There's nothing magic about this place other than we were really given an opportunity, again, by our board of directors and our industry to experiment. They never looked over our shoulder and said, do this, don't do that. The book thing that we have done came out of, frankly, I remember the exact time it happened is that I was really anxious to see Neil Sheehan's book, The Bright Shining Lie, about the Vietnam War. I grew up in the Vietnam War. It was a very difficult time for our country, and I don't think we've really ever recovered from it. And I think that was a real bad beginning for my adult life. And I wanted to find out what Neil Sheehan had found, and I knew what would happen. When his book came out, he'd be on the Today Show for 6 minutes. They'd probably talk about John Paul Vann's sex life, and who was an important character in his book. And I said, this is an opportunity for us to do what they can't do. So I interviewed him for 2.5 hours.
Wow.
Put him on every night for 30 minutes. And then on the fifth night, got him in the studio and opened the phones up and let people talk back to him. That's how we got into books.
Wow. That's like it's like an early version of what's happening on kind of on YouTube or podcast shows like Joe Rogan, where, the, you know, you just go for hours as long as people are interested in and calling in and whatnot.
And it's a magnificent evolution, and almost everything has been done before. It's just that finally, after the government got out of the way of overregulating the cable television business and then got out of the way of preventing the domestic satellite from being put up there over a 10-year period when it could have been done, when it was done internationally, and you just keep going down all those alleys. Once this thing blew open with the internet and with cable and with satellite, that now you can, any human being in this country can dream about doing something in video and audio, and they don't have to ask anybody's permission.
You know, you are a longtime critic, and you were just articulating some of this, of many government policies that supposedly ensure fairness in media. You're against the fairness doctrine, which mandated, I mean, it's gone now, but which mandated equal time for different points of view on broadcast media. You were outspoken in Reason and elsewhere in past interviews against must-carry provisions for cable companies. And you're no fan of content regulation on cable or on the internet. Why is that? And is there a kind of governing philosophy there for you?
This is not well thought out on my part. It's just the way I've always felt. The idea of having a government employee sitting in an office at the FCC determining what's fair and not fair, it seems to me to be a joke. You know, what's fair today would not have been fair 20 years ago. And we're better off, in spite of the fact that we don't like a lot of what's going on the internet right now, we're better off if there is the freedom out here to say and do what you want to do and let the marketplace make that decision. I can't stand the idea of regulation of content. And I can't stand the idea that government officials, including the Supreme Court, want to determine what we can see and not see and how our dollars are being spent. It's just the way, I can't describe it to you. I don't give it anybody any blame or credit for that. It's just the way I grew up, and I'm not even sure I'm right. It's just, you know, I played it out in my lifetime, and I'm sure a lot of people who love the fairness doctrine would totally disagree with this, because back in the day when I was involved in the government trying to get rid of the fairness doctrine, the right wing and the left wing loved it because they thought they could help control the content by having a fairness doctrine. And if it wasn't for the release of the Fairness Doctrine, you wouldn't have started with a Larry King show. They would have never taken a chance.
If you
had to match everybody's comment on radio with somebody else's comment, they wouldn't have taken a chance.
Do you worry that that we're going through a new cycle, you know, whether it's through net neutrality rules or limiting the legal immunity of websites and ISPs under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act? Are we moving into a new cycle of attempts by the government or, you know, in lockstep with corporations to kind of limit expression?
I don't worry about it. I'm too old to worry about stuff like that. And, you know, 25, 30, 40 years ago, I would have worried about it. However, it is the nature of Washington, D.C. The cycles continue. No matter what we did 30 years ago, we're going to go back and do it again. And when people get into power, they love control. And the best way to look at that is the cameras in the House and the Senate are under the control of the House and the Senate. No matter how hard we've tried to put our own cameras in there, they want to protect what people can see. And it's the same way with the Supreme Court. Those judges over there, those justices. So I love the Supreme Court. I think it's probably the best run of the three branches in government. But the idea that they have hunkered down and said, we're not going to let you see 75 one-hour arguments a year in which no decisions are made just drives me crazy, because there's just really no excuse for it. And they are tough, important, and they're smart, and the Chief Justice knows how to use his gavel. And so we are deprived of seeing that just because of this thing that gets in people's head who get in government that they want to control what people see.
Yeah, now, I mean, that's kind of your white whale, right, to get cameras inside the Supreme Court's oral arguments. And do you see any hope that any of that will change as maybe the court gets younger? Or is it simply that, you know, power doesn't want to reveal itself if it doesn't have to?
I have no hope in my lifetime that cameras will get into the Supreme Court, primarily because when the new younger members come into the court and they testify, they always say they're for television. Hmm. And about 6 months into the time that they get on the court, they all of a sudden said, well, I've taken a look at it, and I think it's probably better off that we not televise. And the reason they do that is their colleagues sit there and say, there's no way we're going to go on television, and we don't want them in here, because once they get in here, it's going to change the court. And so it's a collegial thing. And I understand that from a human standpoint, but it's going to take somebody years from now who says it's time for the rest of the country to see what we do here in that little tiny courtroom.
It's could you try and offer them like where you'll just show their hands during the oral arguments, like old mob trial or mob hearings or something like that?
I love the idea, because it reminds me of when we went to the House years ago, and suggested that it's time to let our cameras in. And they came back to us and made a proposal to us that we would allow them to rope off a corner of the House of Representatives. And that when they were negotiating with one another, they would go back into that roped off area and we would agree not to show that on camera. That's a true story.
So obviously you've been involved in government and media since the Vietnam era, and you mentioned previously that, you know, Vietnam was a kind of shock to the system in so many different ways, including, I guess back in the day, people used to talk about the credibility gap between particularly what Lyndon Johnson was saying and what people kind of knew to be true, or the government. I mean, this is the moment where, you know, and you can locate it at various points in American history, but, you know, whether it's the Warren Commission, whether it's the Gulf of Tonkin, whether it's, you know, reports about how we're winning in Vietnam, all of this kind of stuff. But, you know, there's just this split at a moment where it became harder and harder to take government pronouncements, official government, seriously. And that proceeded throughout the 70s with things like the Church Commission and the Rockefeller Commission talking about how the government was surveilling people, all of this type of stuff. You know, we now live in an age of fake news, of endless conspiracies, and hyperpolarization, which, you know, I don't think is disconnected from that. Do you think things are better or worse or about the same when it comes to, you know, faith in media, politicians, and kind of public engagement? I mean, are we in a better place now? Because we definitely have more information, but does it just lead to more and more disillusionment and people being bothered by things?
I'm not smart enough to know how to answer that question other than to say that as an individual, I have far more information available to me today if I want to use it. If I want to rely on Twitter and not pay attention to the behind-the-scenes, in-depth kind of coverage that you can still get, I can do that, and an awful lot of people do. I've always said there's really the 10%ers in the United States that pay attention, worry about government, the future, and all that stuff. The rest of the people just go on about their lives, and I think they've sadly learned not to trust their government. However, having said that, they
wait. But when you say it's sadly don't trust their government, but you're not necessarily saying the government is trustworthy, are you?
I am not.
Yeah.
No, as a matter of fact, it's funny. I interviewed a woman 2 weeks ago. And we ran it on the network, and she was, her name is Amy Greenberg. She's a professor from Penn State. She did a book on the wife of James Polk, who was our president back in the 1800s. And at one point in the interview, I said, "Are you saying that James Polk lied us into the Mexican War?" And she said, "Absolutely." And it just struck me. I mean, it's usually never quite that simple, but people have lied us into wars forever, and in the situation with Vietnam, they were not able to sell us on the value of being there, but they had lied us into that and lied to us during the war, and it just so happened that I was in the Pentagon at the time helping them lie, and that had a big impact on me personally, and I think the fact that the drugs got into it and they were never able to convince us, the leaders were never able to convince us that that was a smart war to fight, that it's had a lasting impact on us. So, I don't know. I mean, you see the polls all the time, and the polls are not very reassuring that people are paying attention. When the last poll I heard was that only 26% of the American people can identify the three branches of government. So we've lost something in this process, and I must say that's disappointing when I think about the fact we've been in business for 40 years, and I would always think along the way that this might help people get to know more than they did before, but it doesn't seem to be working.
What's next for C-SPAN? What are your second 40 years going to look like, and what's the unfinished business and the mountains you still hope to climb?
Well, this is sounds a little bit pessimistic, but our next requirement and responsibility is to survive. The economic model is changing in front of our eyes. People are dropping cable all over the country. The kids don't watch television. They watch their phones. And our revenue stream is entirely based on the number of homes that are connected to C-SPAN. And it used to be 100 million. It's down to 88 million. And so where that goes, we're not sure. And we've had a tremendous go up till now, but I'm just not sure how strongly the people will as the ownership changes. That's the key thing. Who's going to own these things, and will they be civic-minded? There's a lot more available in civics through YouTube, internets, websites, podcasts than we ever dreamed. So we have got to continue to convince people who pay our bills, and they pay us about $70 million a year, which in television is not a lot of money, that we still have value. Some people are 150% with us, and others are skittish because they're changing, they're selling the businesses. And so we're in the middle of that right now, fortunately or unfortunately.
So are you thinking of a reality TV series built around AOC and maybe some of the younger, hipper members, a real world, MTV-style real world, but in D.C.?
Nick Gillespie, as you well know, if you did something like that, it would sell.
Well, I hope, I wish you, Brian, and C-SPAN another great 40 years.
Nick, I'd like to think that you and I would be around in 40 years to do this again. Something tells me it's not going to work out very well for us. But you've always been a terrific, terrific supporter of what we do, and I just thank you for being there.
Oh, well, thank you. We have been talking. We're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Brian Lamb. He is the founder of C-SPAN, which has been around for 40 years, adding to public discourse in a way that virtually no other organization or no other news outlet or media outlet certainly has. Brian, it's a pleasure.
Thanks, Nick.
And this has been The Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Apple, at Google, at Spotify, at Reason.com, at wherever you get your podcasts on. Thanks so much for listening.